Welcome back to another episode of the Chats with Clark podcast. I'm your host, Joe Clark, and here at Chats with Clark, we don't do poppy intros. We get straight to the point. And the point of today's episode, actually, before we get into it, how many of us thought about waking up today and deciding we were going to row at all? What about across the Atlantic Ocean? Well, the four gentlemen that are here with me today go by Seneca Navy. They're Team Seneca Navy, and that's exactly what they are going to do starting in December. And the members are David Rainey, Anthony, known by Tony as the fans, Corella, Mo Marchart, and Ryan Malfler. Gentlemen, thank you all for being here.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having us, Joe.
So right off the rip, fellas, I have to ask you, one of you was crazy enough to originally say, hey guys, I have this really great idea. We're going to row across the Atlantic Ocean. So how did that story go? And let's hear it.
Yeah, I'm the one that all their parents kind of hate a little bit. I had come to originally Mo and Tony here. We were only a grade apart in college on the same rowing team. That's how we met each other. But after we had graduated, I was living out of town and just kind of looking for the next big thing in life. And I had known about this race a little bit. I'd known about ocean rowing a little bit. And I just thought about it and sat on it and eventually just gave kind of a formal pitch to them. I literally sat down and did a presentation with them. So it started in the group chat, like all good ideas, right? And so I shot them a message and said, literally, anyone trying to row across the Atlantic? And he responded first and said, when and where? So it was
I think the where was...
Right. That's what I always say.
It's kind of implied.
I need a start line, man. Yeah. I need to know where the start line is, how we get here.
Yeah. So I mean, we sat on it from another year from then. That's back in 2021, 2022.
Yeah, okay.
And then, you know, whatever, 10 months later, I sat them down again with a formal presentation that was, this is why I think this endeavor is the next logical step in our lives, which it's not, you know, it's Absolutely. Just I was making the pitch. Yeah. So we thought about it for a while. They were in. We decided that we wanted to be competitive in the race because we're racing against 40, 45 other teams. So we wanted to add a fourth team member. And then we wanted to add someone that was on our college rowing team with us. And you know, we had a series of discussions, did the full weighted factor rating analysis, all these different qualities that we knew were important to this race. And we ultimately settled on Ryan.
Congrats on being drafted number one. That's pretty well done. Yeah.
We asked a lot more people first. No, I'm kidding.
You're the weak link. You're the one going overboard when it gets a little gets rough. Yeah. And so was there any hesitation, like right off the rip? Like, what were you guys thinking when, because if I were to hear, right, like much like many plans that start in the group message, this grandiose idea that in this case is overtly crazy. I mean, you all are crazy to some degree for doing this, which is awesome. That's a lot of great things. Was there any, like, how are we even going to tackle this? I mean, like, where do you start, right? Like, that'd be my first thing. It's like, kind of like when and where, like, how do we even go about this?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, for me at least, like, what I, you know, being that first message in the chat, you know, sent it off as like that was kind of like, I guess, the culture of the group, like me, myself, Dave, and Mo, and then Ryan, of course, that's why he's here. But like, just doing things together and like always, you know, wanting to join in on the fun, never kind of like backing down from a challenge. So kind of sent that message as like, you know, a joke, and then it's like, okay, let's see where this goes, because. Like, what is this? I never heard of a race, or it's not like I knew what was really being asked. You know, just like, yeah, sure, you know, this is funny. And then once, you know, Dave kind of said, you know, there's this thing, like, watch this video. I was like, oh, this is real. Okay, let's take a step back and, you know, where do we actually start? Like, how much is it? You know, there's a million questions that come after it, but.
It's so true.
Yeah, I don't know what your reaction was like, but.
I mean, it definitely took me a while to commit to it. My girlfriend always like said when I first told you that Dave was trying to row across the ocean, and I was like, yeah, I'm probably not gonna do it. And then I watched some like documentaries about it, and it just seemed so horrible. Like, it seemed like the best thing ever. Like, everyone's seasick. Yeah, but like after a while, I just thought about like what if we can actually do this? What if we can pull this off? And then, I ended up committing to the project, and I think we're in a fairly good track so far.
So half assured.
Yeah.
Ryan, do you have anything that you were thinking about?
Yeah. I actually remember when you were like on a couple months before he committed.
Yeah,
I was. He was living in Boston at the time. I was home for winter break. I was still in school, and I came into Boston. We did like a workout together in Riverside Boat Club, And he said, oh yeah, Dave's like thinking he's gonna row across the ocean or something. I was like, wow, that's crazy. And then conversation just kind of stopped after that. And I was like, oh, that's pretty cool that, you know, you could do that. And then a couple months later, I'm in Florida, we're on our training trip, and I get a text from Mo saying, hey, we're just pretty committed to rowing across the ocean. Is it something that you would consider doing? And at first, you know, the idea of, you know, I'd been kind of interested in that ultra stuff for a little bit, you know, doing like a 100K race or something like that. Yeah. So the ocean was like a big step up. And at first I was like, that's impossible. Like, how can you, I didn't even really believe people could do that.
Right.
And just all the logistics seemed really, you know, daunting. And I was still in college. So I was like, you know, how do I don't even know what my next steps are. And then the answer just kind of appeared to me as like, this is what the next step is. Like the opportunity just presented itself. And I kind of came to the realization I'd be a fool to pass it up. And I've like pretty much never looked back from that decision. And I know I'm on the right track because the person that, you know, this adventure from the moment we started to where we are now, and I still believe when we finish, is the person, you know, it's the track of the person that we want to be. We're on that, you know, that good path.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd love to hear about those qualities in a second from you guys. I was thinking about that prior to us recording. I'm like, you're going to be in such a select group of individuals to even take on the endeavor and then let alone finish it when that time comes. And I think that those opportunities, like you mentioned, are so hard to, like, you can't pass that up. When something like that happens, you just got to take the bull by the horns, as the saying goes, and ride with it, because you at the end of it will be like, you'll forever be known as someone who has done something like that. And I don't even mean it in like a legacy sense. That's all cool and well, whatever. But just in the sense that in your conversations, your day-to-day life, you're going to be influenced so much by having done that experience. That's so incredible to me.
Yeah.
You know, I was thinking about that. I'm like, how many people have done this? Right. I mean, that's so, I'd never heard of such a thing.
It's not a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Up until I think it was surpassed in the last couple years. But the big stat in ocean rowing was more people had been to space than had rowed an ocean. And I think they just passed it, but it's just, it shows you, you know, shows you how unique that pool of people are.
It is, yeah. I think this whole situation for you guys is an anomaly too. For everyone that's listening in the audience, definitely head to the website and hear more about this background. But I'm curious, all four of you are from different places. So I'm gonna let you all touch on that. How did this manage that you ended up being together, right? I think, I know you kind of gave us the story a little bit of like everyone texting and that kind of thing, going to school, but truly, for you to all land in that place and to row together and then to know, hey, we could actually be a great team, is something like astronomically, seemingly illogical, like for you, for where you're all coming from. So
yeah,
why don't we touch on that a little bit?
Yeah, no, just, you know, we all met together at Hobart College. These two were the same grade. I was a year older. He was a couple years younger. It's a less than 2,000 student school in the middle of upstate New York on the Finger Lakes. Beautiful campus. But when you look at the collegiate rowing scene and the top 20 teams in the country, it's all big state schools or Ivy Leagues, and then Hobart College, tiny little program. So it was a place that we kind of all went to for rowing, you know, some recruited, some not, but all just happenstance. It was one of the last schools that I had applied to, but it just ended up going there. They had all sorts of different reasons for going there, and it's something that was just one of the best things that happened to all of us. The culture of the rowing team that we are on is a huge part of why we're doing this. It's really the fundamental reason that we are.
What would you say that culture is?
Our coach's mission, his personal mission for the team, was to provide a platform for student athletes to pursue the best version of themselves. And so that is something that deeply resonated with all of us. And that is, we spent months when we decided that this team was the team to do this, figuring out our why. What's our collective why that we're going to tell people that we're spending 3 years of our lives preparing for this? And it was, we wanted to push that mission that we experienced, you know, in this rowing program out into the world for more people to experience. So, you know, we went through the steps of creating our own nonprofit, and the mission of that nonprofit is to provide opportunities for youth to pursue better versions of themselves. Right. So all of our partner charities that we're raising funds for all in some way have separate missions that fall under that umbrella and support that endeavor. So that was the reason that we all kind of that mission resonated with us so much that we just spent so much time outside of rowing, which is difficult in itself, doing other training sessions, you know, doing kind of long runs together, long bikes. And it was just, it was a tight knit group amongst a tight knit group. Right.
Yeah.
So it was just, it made sense for us. Yeah.
Tony, you're from Canada. Mo, you're from Germany. And Ryan, you're from Boston area in Massachusetts here in the States. You all end up in this small school up in New York. I mean, it's almost, seems divine, right? And then you're taking on this adventure. What led you to New York in the first place?
So, I mean, where I come from back in, the little town is Kleinberg. So, just right in Bonn, and you know, it's like people are either playing soccer or hockey there, and like nobody's rowing. Like I don't know anybody that rowed from that area. Like maybe a couple people, but like I grew up playing hockey my whole life. Played a couple other sports, but it was very focused on hockey. I ended up in the States at school in Maine, just playing, trying to go to college and like keep hockey going, and played my last year of hockey in Maine. And then my college counselor just said to me, you know, we send a couple kids to Hobart and William Smith colleges every year. It's a great school. Like I was interested in environmental science, and she said, you know, they have a good program there, and I really think you'd like it. The advisor or the recruiter is coming on campus. It was like, this week, why don't you go meet with them? I was the only kid from the school that went to go meet with this recruiter. Shout out Sue Willard. And we had a discussion, and she explained everything to me, and I was like, okay, I'll apply. They didn't need the SAT score, they didn't require that. So I was like, all right, perfect. this should work out okay. But you know, I was actually starting to do better in school that year, and I ended up getting an academic scholarship to Hobart. And then I showed up, you know, not planning on joining any teams. I was looking to maybe try out for the lacrosse team. And I had sent the rowing coaching email earlier, just as like, you know, this will be my backup. I'll just join the rowing team. I was doing all this research, you know, showing that people had, like to join in college is a completely normal thing as like a novice, which I didn't know. So I was like, okay, this doesn't go well with the lacrosse thing. I'll try and join the rowing team. Like, why not? It looks really cool. But honestly, I was pulling up these like old YouTube videos of like Hobart rowing and like the Canadian national team, and just seeing all these like early 2000s or like 2014 like Hobart videos of like them in the erg room, and just being like, wow, this looks sick. Like just these men like just working out on rowing machines and just being machines and
getting after
like
it.
Yeah, just getting after it. And I was like, oh, this is cool. You know what? I could see myself doing that. So showed up to campus, and I just, you know, went for a visit, and I saw the campus on the lake, and I knew I wanted to go yeah. there. I said to my parents, like, this is just so cool. Like I can't pass this up. It's either here or I'm going to some school, one of the universities in like Southern Ontario. And I don't know. It's just nothing on those schools, but this was much better for me.
Isn't that crazy? Right? Like you can connect it. You named Sue Willard. It's amazing. Yeah. You can connect all the dots looking backward. That's what like is so amazing to me.
Can I tell you my favorite anecdote about him joining the team?
Happily.
our head coach is real kind of hard-o guy. You know, just like no excuses, that kind of old school toughness, but you know, really intuitive as well and really smart. I'm gonna tell my version of it. I don't know how right it is, but it's the one that I remember. He was in the middle of, you know, possibly trying out for the lacrosse team, but also going to these, you know, rowing team tryouts at the same time. And he showed a lot of promise in his first session or two, you know, just big, strong kid. Like coach is like, all right, I can mold this kid. And, he was trying to get out of the Saturday practice because he wanted to go to the lacrosse tryout that morning. And this is the day before. And our coach goes up to him, puts his hand on his shoulder and goes, son, you're not going to that lacrosse tryout tomorrow.
Yeah, it was something like that. But he was definitely, you know, very persuasive. You know, he was saying, oh, because I hadn't gone on the water yet. And the Saturday was a water practice because I think beginning of the year was like erg for the first week and something like that. Anyways. So he was like, no, you gotta come on the water. You're like, you gotta come Saturday. Yeah. You can't go to this lacrosse. Like, go another day. And I was like, okay, I'll send him an email, see if I can come, like, for whatever. Because I think that coach was just saying, you know, come throughout these days. And then I said to him, well, I think I'm gonna go to the water practice. But I kind of knew that if I was saying that to the lacrosse coach, I was like, yeah, that in itself is already not a good first step. So it looks like I'm probably going to be wrong. So I showed up and I thought it was really cool. I'm just thinking of a video. I can send it to you guys after, but like just one of my first rowing practices and just being so like out of tune. There was another novice in front of me too. And like It's like people are, you know, like rowing an eight, like you have to be in just such unison. And this video is just like everybody's rowing, and then there's two guys smack in the middle of the boat, just like literally not in the rhythm at all. Like, I don't even know how we didn't just crush some of the person's back in front of us with our oar. And yeah, I don't know what was going on, but yeah, ended up at that tryout or that practice on the water. And yeah, the rest was history. I actually got, I think the order of things was, went to that practice the next week. Our coach gave me like one of his old unis because I didn't have any like trout or like rowing uniform, I guess you would call it, to work out in. So he like handed me his old like Reebok trout that was like probably 20 years old and was like, here, use this for the next few practices.
Hadn't been washed.
It's like sharing underwear, dude.
Yeah, it's
like,
weird. Yeah. He definitely thought you were a prodigy.
For sure, he was like, hey, take this and let's get this thing going. So,
yeah. Mo, who is your Sue Willard? What took you to Hobart?
I think my Sue Willards are Skip Gield and Lukian Maratovic. I was actually applying to a bunch of schools for rowing, so I was recruited for rowing to come study in the US. Really happy I had that opportunity. And at the end, why I chose Hobart was because that coach back then, he actually is like a Olympic level coach in San Francisco now. He spent hours with me on the phone practicing for the TOEFL, which is the test of English for a foreign language. So I had to do that before I applied to any colleges in the States. He just spent hours on the phone practicing with me for that.
Okay.
And then the second thing is Lukian, one of our teammates, 2 years older than me. I wasn't able to visit any of the campuses, so he just like spent like half a day with me on FaceTime, just like showing me everything on campus. And that's kind of the two things that persuaded me that Hobart was the right place. And yeah, I think it turned out to be.
How are you, Ryan?
Okay, so the name stands out for me would be Austin Letourneau. He was a Hobart rower one of the best Hobart rowers I've gone through. Hobart rowing. You know, he spent a stint on the national team. In my senior year of high school, he came back to my hometown where, you know, we went through the same program at Hingham, and he was coaching us there, an assistant coach. And I was thinking I wanted to go lightweight rowing. So there's not that many heavyweight teams in the country. There's far less lightweight teams. So lightweight, you got to make weight. You got to be, you know, 150 pounds. Watch what you eat. And I figured I could just be a little bit more competitive because, you know, smaller guy. So, I was talking to the coaches about my prospect schools, and Hobart's a heavyweight team. So there's no lightweight programs. And, talking to the coaches there, you know, being a smaller guy, they looking at my 2K times, they were like, yeah, you're not going to make a boat here. But Austin, he was like, nah, dude, just go to Hobart. Like he fully invested. You know, he's like, don't go lightweight. You'll hate it. You can definitely make it on that Hobart team. So that's what brought me to Hobart, was kind of that belief in a mentor believing in my capability there. And looking back, you know, I made the second varsity eight. I made the first varsity eight. So the initial doubt that I had in myself, it was kind of all for naught because, you know, I trusted what that mentor saw in me.
Yeah, absolutely. It touches on what you all kind of alluded to with your why, in the sense of your coach believing in who that future person is and pushing you to be that person. And it's all these people that did it even like before that, right?
Yeah.
So when you get there and you're emerging on this journey, and again, anyone that was rowing with you or who would have been rowing before that guy pushing you to go there, they're not rowing the ocean with you. You know, that's incredible.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's incredible. Touching on your why, David, you mentioned that a little bit earlier with in regards to starting the nonprofit and going that whole route. Probably something that none of you were familiar with before doing this.
No.
What was that like? How did you dive in and kind of get your feet wet, and what did you learn along the way with that?
Oh, man, just everything. Part of my initial pitch to these two was, and this was prophetic but totally blind. Like, I don't even know what I was saying, but it ended up being totally true, was I don't think that either pursuing this race or not doing it and pursuing our professional careers are mutually exclusive. I think they're actually very symbiotic and can work with each other. To that point, I mean, we've literally launched a business that is a nonprofit that has, you know, marketing, finance, and operations, and we're legitimately running a business that has kind of paid off, I think, huge in our professional careers now and certainly to come. To your point, we had no idea what we were doing. So it just started with asking, you know, trying to outline what we don't know, trying to identify resources that can fill in the knowledge gap. Forming the nonprofit, you know, huge legal implications, trying to file all those forms, the IRS and all this kind of stuff. We had a coxswain, or the smaller people that drive the boats in college. We had one of my best friends in my grade, Steven, at Hobart, that we all, you know, knew and really appreciated. Ended up going to Cornell Law School. And while he was there and we were talking to him about what we're doing, he goes, "Oh, great, Cornell Law School has a pro bono entrepreneurial clinic where they'll do the legal work for you for free if you can get in." He got us in. We've been clients of theirs for 2.5 years straight. They've done everything for us, you know, pro bono. Just little relationships like that, you know, people that have been kind of guiding us. We set up an advisory board of kind of, you know, industry professionals to show us what we're doing wrong, what we're missing. Really kind of risk adverse and just asking every single question under the sun to figure this out. It's just so much.
Yeah. How did you all decide who you're going to partner with? Because I'm sure that has to be tough too. You got to find someone that aligns with you and then make it happen.
It took a long time. You know, we kind of initially thought like, oh, we're going to find one national charity maybe, or we need to have this done before we kind of start fundraising or do anything else. And it was totally wrong. You know, we ended up just happening very organically. We established a partnership with our first partner charity, the Boys and Girls Club of Geneva in New York, the town that the college is in, very early on. But then it took probably 9 or 10 months to sign, you know, our three other partner charities to an agreement. Because to your point, there needs to be mission alignment. There needs to be someone that wants to work with us. We don't want to just write a check at the end of this, which is great, but we want to develop relationships and partnerships over this 3-year course that are actually mutually beneficial, and then great at the end, we can give them the cherry on top, you know, a huge check.
Yeah, it's amazing. I've always heard it divided in like your time, your talent, your treasure, right? Like it's a very
exactly
very sound way of looking at it. So have you been able to, I mean, obviously the time is going to come, but have you been able to kind of work with these organizations outside of that? Like where is the youth in them? How are you going about helping youth actually strive towards that person that is their best self?
Yeah. For me or for anyone?
Sounds like he wants to pass it off, gentlemen.
No, I'm happy to. I was just like, I don't.
Yeah, I was going to actually start just to backtrack a bit. It was like one of the first lessons I think I learned, I think we all learned, was like when we started creating these relationships or like getting these things going, I think the first thought was always, at least for me, you guys can probably relate, but it was like, oh, we need a partner charity. Who wouldn't want to, you know, take the money that we raise from this thing? And then we found out, oh, there's charities that it doesn't, what we're doing doesn't actually align with what they're doing. Okay, let's look for some more people. And then who wouldn't want to sponsor, get their name on the boat or something? And then you go and reach out to this person, you're like, ah, they're gonna say yes, they're gonna do it. And then it's like, okay, like we need to go to this next person now because they weren't really interested or it just didn't work out. And that lesson of like, you gotta go into things with like an open mind, but at the same time, you're not gonna get what you want at the first shot. Like it's gonna take time. It's gonna take like all your effort, and you gotta build relationships and then utilize the people that you know, the relationships that you already have, and like really foster those to get, get the ball rolling. Like the more people you have like in the cause, I think, helping out the cause, feeling like they're being supportive and they're a part of the mission is where you start to, I guess, start getting some like real progress. So at least for me, you know, I just thought, oh, who wouldn't want to, you know, help us out or whatever. And then, you know, sometimes the two things don't align and you need to just keep pushing. But
that has to be unique because you guys are doing something so cool and you're helping people along the way. Mm-hmm. And so it's weird that someone wouldn't want to dive into that. But when you talk about business, I suppose it has that different thing. So I can imagine that being a little bit of a shock.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would think the same thing. Yeah. It's like, oh, why wouldn't you want to do this? This is all great. And how many people do you know that are doing this?
Right? Yeah. No, it's totally, it's kind of every, it's as challenging as we thought it would be, but more. And it just, you know, we've had to pivot kind of way more than I think we thought that we would. Mm-hmm. You know, we thought that it would be a lot of work, but everything would kind of go our way. And it's just, oh my gosh, how many times have we been told no, you know? But this is a group that I've just never seen anyone waver at all on anything. I mean, it's just like, okay, what's the next best decision? What's the next move?
Yeah.
You know, just keep moving forward.
I kept thinking about the resilience that you would all have to have, particularly on the ocean. And then I was thinking about it. I'm like, they've been preparing for this for so long.
Yeah.
What has this process taught you about being resilient more than even just the physical? I feel like the physical in this situation kind of speaks for itself. You're never going to be prepared for it. You're obviously training like mad. What about on the other areas?
Yeah, as far as like what the process has taught us about resilience, I think we can kind of bring it back to our days just at Hobart doing just competitive rowing, competitive racing. To me, you know, the 2K is one of the most painful physical events you can do. And the best way you get through that is, you know, as Dave was saying, take it one next step, best, the next best step. Mm-hmm. You take it one stroke at a time. So I think this process has taught us to really segment of our decision making, segment our perspective, you know, our campaign. You know, if we knew where we'd be right now 3 years ago, we'd probably be jumping with joy with the amount of money that we've raised. I remember thinking at the start, we have to raise how much money? Who's gonna give us that? And you know, there's some optimism. We had a lot of ideas about, you know, corporate sponsorships, and that those ideas have drastically changed over the course of our campaign. You know, what we initially thought would work didn't. What we initially thought didn't work did. So there's been a lot of kind of, you know, fluidity with that decision making, and you know, it even brings it back to the race itself, is that, you know, we're going to need to take it, you know, one shift at a time out there.
I'm very excited to dive into what that whole process is going to look like. I want to touch on that in a bit.
That'd be a good one.
Yeah. As a quick aside, if someone listening were to donate, let's give a little instruction here. I'll put it all in the links below, but let's just plug it while we can here, fellas. I'm not going to beat around the bush.
Right on the website, homepage, beautiful. Big donate button.
It's beautiful. Any consumer can come in and do so.
Absolutely. We've raised everything through private donations and corporate sponsorships. So if it's a company that wants to get their logo on the boat, they can strike up a conversation with us or just donate there. If it's someone that wants to give $10 and support it, they can do it on the website.
It's for the kids, right? Yeah, it's right on Mo's hat. It says for the kids.
For the kids.
It's perfect. And
what I also want to add here, that as they said, we started our own charity. We have 501c3 registered, so everything is tax deductible, which might also be.
Love it. Good. Sales pitch. Yeah. This is perfect. I feel amiss not bringing it up, right?
Yeah.
Gents, another aspect of it that I was thinking about is just the teamwork, right? You had mentioned earlier, Ryan, that you were saying, it all has to be, no, it was Tony. I see, I've got you guys flip flops for whatever reason. You're talking about like the unison of the rowing.
Tony's so, yeah.
What's that?
Tony's the handsome one.
You guys all are great. So, Tony, you were mentioning earlier that the rowers all have to be in unison, right? And I was thinking just across the board, when you're doing what you're about to embark upon, there has to be so much cohesiveness. What has this whole process taught you about teamwork, or what could you say you feel like you contribute going, you know, in your spot in the team?
Yeah, I would say another, you know, I love the big lessons. I like to think about the bigger picture. And another like big lesson, I guess, or thing that was said to us was that it was from Matt Brown, who's on our advisory board. He did the race. He's a world record holder. Just an insane human. Great looking guy too. You know, we got a lot of great looking dudes on this team all around. But he said to us, at each point, at any point in time, one of us is going to be the strongest and one of us is going to be the weakest link. And I found that it's not even like on the boat or during the row, you know, that's obviously going to be a piece of it, but it's like when we're at the house and we're getting stuff ready for the row, it's like you see it. It's like you always, the teamwork is like always just being there to back up your buddy. Like, there's times where, you know, it's just like the smallest thing we need to do. Like this weekend, we were preparing for the row, for our last training row. and I was putting tape around the on the foot plate for your heel so you don't get blisters. And I had done two of them. There's three foot plates. You probably didn't even, or maybe you know what I'm talking about.
I know you didn't want to do it.
I was feeling, I was probably the weakest link in that moment. It was such a small task. And I was doing this tape and I had done the two. And then Dave goes, oh, you want to do that third one? And I was just like, the gesture was just like, oh, I got to tape. And it takes like 2 seconds to do the thing. But I was just so dead from the day. I was helping his brother wash a boat that day in the heat. So I was just like tired. And I was like, oh man, that's the last thing I want to do right now. I just want to go have a sip of water. And it's like in that moment, I was like, oh, okay, even in this such a small task, like, I'm the weakest link. And then he was like, oh dude, don't worry, I can do it for you if you want. But I was like, no, don't worry, I'll do it. It's fine. It's not a big deal. But like that constant like backing each other up, even in little moments, is I would say where you really like realize the teamwork. And that's, it's just become like second nature, I would say, for us. Like there's, if one of us is struggling, there's always going to be somebody that comes in. And you know, just because we live in such tight quarters on land and in the boat, we talked a bit about that too, but you know, we're all living in the same house and you know, we're always bumping into each other and stuff, but it's just second nature that, you know, you realize when somebody needs a hand and you lend it at all times.
Yeah. I mean, I'm motivating, right? Like, yeah. Did you end up doing it too?
I mean, I wasn't going to say,
see,
you know, I wasn't going to be like, oh, I can't do this right now.
Right. But, yeah. Like you push through. Just the gentle gesture of like, oh, like I got you. If it's too much, that you're like, no, it's not too much. I got this. Yeah. And I feel like that's so motivating.
Yeah.
If you had been like, dude, just do it, man, I would have been like, no, you fucking do it.
Yeah, right. It's like, no, I'm not doing this. And you got it.
Yeah. I could tell he didn't want it. So I was like, whatever.
Yeah, I'll do it. Right. Yeah.
I'll do the tape and Tony. Okay. Take five.
Yeah. It kind of like makes me think just back to the original, right where we started off. Like, I feel like these unique experiences are what you end up talking about when it's like when 20 years from now, when you're applying for some job, when you're giving a sales pitch about yourself and you have to like, right? Like these are the stories that you end up telling, and it's the fact that you did the tape in the moments when you're preparing for the big race and all those sorts of things that set you apart. I mean, it's just, you've started nonprofits, you're doing all this great work, and then you're going to go row the ocean. I mean, that's, you've learned so much from one experience. Of course, it's been, I'm sure, what feels like a winded one at times, and sometimes mm-hmm. probably very quick, but those are the experiences that I feel like just really transform our lives. It's quite incredible. So a thought that I always like to think about too is kind of this notion that when we're in life, there's those moments when we're kind of in the thick of it, right? Like we're in the mud and it's tough to keep going. I've done a bike ride that David knows about here like 3 or 4 times now, where you ride a bicycle from Pittsburgh to DC, which is nowhere near as far as the Atlantic Ocean, but regardless, it's kind of a far physical endeavor. And there's those moments when you're out of the 70 miles in a day, 80 miles in a day, you're 20 miles in and you've seen the exact same site and you're literally in mud and trying to pedal and it's difficult. When that happens to you all, whatever the rowing analogy would be in the ocean, or maybe the waves are high, whatever, it's the middle of the night, I mean, you're not stopping. So how do you plan when you're in the thick of it to keep going, to motivate each other in that teamwork sense? What does that look like?
I think, or at least what helped me a lot during these really tough moments, often it's like when the weather is really bad and we're seasick, or if it's just like at night and it seems like you're falling asleep on the oars, like it literally feels like you could, if you lose your focus, you would like fall asleep while you're rowing. I think it's, for me, it's coming back to the team, to just talk to whoever else is on deck, and kind of distract you from the uncomfortableness of the experience. And I think that's, just having everyone else on the team to talk to and to rely on is something that, just helps a lot to get through these moments. And then we're also working with our sports psychologist, Dr. Derek Mann, which has been incredibly helpful to just make sure our team dynamics are spot on, we can resolve potential, or that we can resolve conflict better. And I think that's one of the most important work that we're doing, and like that psychologist, a psycholog- this mental aspect just also helps a lot to get through these tough moments on the road.
Sure.
Yeah.
Have you found that it's been more mental than physical?
Yeah.
Would you?
Yeah, I think it's definitely just the huge mental challenge of being on the oars for 12, 14 hours a day and just making sure that you continuously give the effort that we need to keep the boat at a certain speed, or doing the, when you're in the cabin and the last thing you do is want to get ready for the next shift. You need to eat, you need to drink, you need to take care of your body. That's just a huge mental thing that, it's just tough to do.
Yeah.
But if you take care of that mental aspect and you do the things that you need to do, then the physical aspect just follows along.
When you're in those tough moments, that why stands through, right? It's like, all right, why are we here in the first place? I always find myself taking myself back, or like trying to focus on something very simple within the five senses. Like, all right, what's good around me? What's beautiful around me? Whatever the case may be, who's around me? What can I tap into that energy, right?
Yeah.
And then you can live throughout that why. It's almost like that's so essential when you're in those moments when you think of it.
Yeah. And we've been, with our, with Dr. Mann, we've been doing a lot of work on figuring out each of our whys, understanding each other's whys. And I really think that's going to be a huge help for us out in the ocean. And we haven't talked about too much about it yet, but it's also a race. It's a race across the ocean. We're trying to be competitive and in that race. And realistically, we're not the most experienced crew. We're racing crews that, for example, this is one crew that has the world record for the Pacific, rowing across the Pacific Ocean, and they're teaming up with maybe the greatest ocean rower of all time. There are teams that are extremely well funded and have been creating their preparation, but I think we can be the best team out there, and that might be a big advantage for us in being competitive.
What will make you the best team out there?
I think just the fact that we know each other for quite a long time is a base, and then the work that we're doing with our with Dr. Mann is really important to support each other. And then, as Tony said, I think we pick each other up really well on the boat. When someone is doing really bad out there, for example, he struggled with seasickness quite a bit during our last row, there's no discussion that the three of us are picking up his shifts. Whoever's the weakest link at that time, we just work for each other to keep going.
Yeah.
Let's paint the picture, Mo. You're right. We haven't actually kind of dove into it. So you guys take off. Where are we coming from? What does the day-to-day look like? How long are we on the ocean? I mean, let's hear it.
I'll paint the full picture.
Paint the full picture.
From the history. It was 1888 or 86.
Yeah.
The first people to ever row across the ocean, these two Norwegian dudes, did it in a boat that looked like it would have been the lifeboat from the Titanic. Don't know how. But it was so remarkable that nobody else did it for 100 more years. Right? When you set a physical feat like that, it's usually people follow suit because they see that it's possible.
Totally.
It was so insane that people didn't do it for another century. So someone else did it in the 1960s, and then there was another 40-year gap. In the late 90s, the predecessor of the race that we're competing in was established. So this race has been going on annually in some form under some name for the last 30 years.
Wow.
What we're competing in, the race is now called the World's Toughest Row. We start in the Canary Islands off the coast of Africa and cruise row nonstop, unsupported, to the finish in Antigua in the Caribbean. The winners are usually close to 30 to 40 days, but you have everything that you need with you. You have all your food, you have all your supplies, all your safety equipment. You start and you don't stop. You don't stop rowing until you hit the finish line.
David, first thought I have, 30 to 40 days, you obviously have to eat and you're on a boat. And there's no chef. So what's going on? How are you guys managing that? And also, because right, you're shooting to win, so you guys are shooting for that 30 to 40 time day mark. But let's say, for whatever reason, you're sitting at 50. Like, how are you planning? How do you even plan for that kind of food?
So it's
so ambiguous.
Right, it is. And because there's so much ambiguity, right? Even though we're doing it, we do it in December every year because that's when the trade winds are fully developed. You're kind of being pushed by the wind and the waves the majority of the time. But then year to year is different. So there could be faster years, slower years. The race is highly regulated. So the race organizers have a safety team that over the 3 years has been working with us and every other crew in the race to make sure that we have every single piece of equipment that we need, the proper boat, all the training that we need. We've gone through, you know, half a dozen courses that are mandatory to the race. Wow. And they are the ones that say, okay, you guys have done everything that we've required you to do. You've done all the training hours that are required. You guys can ship your boat to the start line. They do another inspection at the start line and say, you guys are good to start the race. Of course, there's a big race entry fee with it, but it's worth having all this support, you know, 30 years of institutional knowledge to tell you how to do this, how to do it safe, and how to do it fast, right?
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they kind of guide you as far as what you'll need, like food-wise or exactly. How you go about it.
Exactly. They guide you as much as possible, but it's still entirely up to the crew to kind of figure out how they want to do it. They, you know, you start at the start line, it's a staggered start by a couple minutes, so essentially all the boats are going at the same time, and there's really no other instruction other than the coordinates of the finish line.
Oh my gosh.
So you can get there how you want, as long as you're rowing. You can work in whatever shifts you want. So there's a ton of, you know, tactical sort of information that we need to test, figure out, see what works, see what doesn't, and every crew is going to be different. So whoever can spend the most time figuring that out is going to be in the best, you know, position. Physically, you know, obviously you need to be fit to be able to do this. You need to train. But even just in that realm, there's several different camps of what past rowers say is the best. You know, mentally, I think we have a huge advantage with our sports psychologist to kind of figure that out because it's a huge part of the battle. But another major facet of being competitive is just who can take care of themselves.
Sure.
Who can address a blister or a sore on their heel or hands on day one so that it doesn't compound and 3 weeks later it's debilitating or infected, right?
Yeah.
And it's hard to do. You know, after you've been rowing for 14 hours a day, the last thing you want to do is kind of take care of yourself. You know, you just want to crawl into the cabin and fall asleep or worse, you know?
Yeah.
So it's really important that we kind of practice having these standards, you know, on the crew, like these are non-negotiables that we need to take care of. Because that's going to set us up for success.
It's all these questions are flooding my mind just of how primitive it is. It's like all the basic, what we call basic things that we don't think of, right? Like if we're hungry, we go to food. If you need to use the restroom, you go to the restroom. Like all of that is off the table when you're on the boat. How are you even thinking of all of those sorts of questions?
Yeah.
Then the answer, you know?
It's like your, right. As to your first thought about how, it kind of goes back to that lesson before, like what you think is going to work isn't going to work. Like,
yeah.
Say like a bathroom solution, right? Like how can we, whatever you want to call it, go to the bathroom as efficiently as possible and as cleanly as possible. Like we had some ideas for that, and now we've moved on to something else. And it's just like you got to think outside the box. But your first thought of like how something on the boat is gonna go and how, or like hey, this would work on the boat, and then you go do it on the boat, and you're like. This is not the way to do it. Like this just gets in everybody's way or it's just like not efficient or stuff like that. So I'm thinking of the bathroom example because we had some like makeups of this.
Well, it was working until you got in charge of it.
It was working, but we found a different solution.
It is more efficient.
That is better. So
I feel like that's where that history comes in too, you know?
Oh yeah.
Like having like all these teams that have done it and people like that in your corner.
Right, and we've tried to meet with as many as possible. We've met with teams that have done it. We get all sorts of different answers, but the best thing is that we get options. We get options that we get to go test,
yeah.
You know, out on the lake during, you know, longer training rows. And the food is a huge one. So the safety team sets out all the requirements that we have to check off. The food requirement is you have to have a certain amount of calories per kilogram of body weight per rower per day. And okay. For a team of four, you have to have 55 days worth of food. So even though we're expected to finish closer to 30, you obviously have a ton of wiggle room just in
case.
Now that food can be whatever you want. a lot of teams do like mostly dehydrated camping meals because we'll use the freshwater maker on board to make water and then boil that and rehydrate the meals. But still, you can only have so many of those in a day. And then the balance between that and 6,000 calories, teams typically make up with snacks, and you can make it whatever you want. Our first longer row in Florida this winter was the first time that we kind of tested putting together daily bags of food and nutrition. And we went really pretty healthy with most of it. And we got out there and we were so seasick, we couldn't like stomach it, you know? Wow. You know, nuts were too like fatty to really digest and all this stuff. It just wasn't working out. Since then, our calories have totally deteriorated in terms of the quality of nutrition. But like, that's what the race organizers say is, it doesn't matter what you take. Take something that you can eat and it's going to make you happy, right? Yeah, sure. And that you're going to get off the oars and look forward to eating, right? Even at 6,000 calories a day, eating, if you can stomach it, like, we're still going to be in a deficit. So yeah, you got to make it as enjoyable as possible.
God. I don't know. I mean, I'm just thinking about eating something disgusting, though, and that feels like awful, like a Twinkie or something. That's...
You'd be surprised.
Really?
Yeah. Like, we don't go that bad usually, sure. But like, I had a lot of Pop-Tarts and Gushers last weekend. You know, I had whole meals that were high quality and nutritious, but when you don't want to stomach that much at 3 a.m, but you're rowing for 2 hours, and you just got off that 2-hour shift, and you just need something, it's going to kind of give you some energy.
Yeah, so we kind of alluded to it a little bit. Like, the game plan is row for 2 hours, break for...
So that's another thing. It's up to the crew how they want to do shifts.
Sure.
The standard shift that a lot of teams do, have done historically and still do because they've had success with it, is 2 hours on, 2 hours off. So out of a team of four, two guys will row while two guys rest, two and two around the clock. Teams that are trying to be more competitive will typically mix that up a little bit. There's three rowing positions on board, so you can row three at a time. The teams that are trying to win the race, like we are trying to do, will row three guys up for the majority of the day, maybe 10 or 12 hours for shorter shifts, you know, 90 minutes on, 30 minutes off. And then at night, they'll switch back to the 2 hours on, 2 hours off, so that you can actually get through a full sleep cycle. Boat will slow down a little bit, but it's cooler out. It's not so hot. Yeah. You know, you can row a little bit longer. You can rest a little bit longer.
So it's kind of like you're just like quick... revitalization periods almost throughout the entirety of the...
And it is surprising. We were talking about this earlier today, like how much you can get revitalized from just a short sleep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, you get 2 or 3 days into a row and you're at a really end of a really hard shift and you're just drained. You're like, I don't think that I could string together another one of these. But you get off the oars, you know, even if it's 30 minutes off, you spend 15 of those minutes just cooling down, eating some food. Maybe you get 8 minutes of sleep, but you wake up and you're just like, okay, I can do this again. You sure. know, it's as much of a mental break as it is your body kind of physically just restoring itself a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
How do you even go to sleep? You know what I mean? Like, how are we doing this on a boat? That's not a cruise.
I don't know. We all sleep. I mean, we were just saying on the way over here, I think most of us just lay down on our back and like, it looks insane.
Looks like you're in a coffin.
I'll look into the cabin and Ryan somehow looks like he's having the best sleep of his life. Like hugging the pillow. I don't know. So I don't know if you want to explain how that works. But
anyway, I don't know. It's funny. So the first time we took the boat out, we did like a 17-hour practice row back in this was like fall of last year, 2024. And we were doing the 2 hours on, 2 hours off. It was our first like overnight row. And each one of us individually after our shift, like our sleep ended, was over and we were getting on deck, we had each asked each other like, did you sleep? And we all had the same answer. Like, I think so. It's weird because you're not, you know, you're not awake for more than 2 hours and you're not asleep for more than 2 hours. So it's this weird state of being of like, you know, normally you wake up in the morning, you're awake for 10 hours, and then you go to bed. This almost feels like
the shortest day ever. Sorry.
Okay, well, yeah. I do math all day for work, so I turn it off as soon as I'm
out. I don't know how you got hired.
You have like 12 days within a day. Yeah. And that's only if you're doing 2 hours on, 2 hours off. Six shifts?
The six shifts.
Do not show this to the clique.
So you have 2 hours on, 2 hours off. That's 4 hours for one shift, basically. And you do that 6 times
a day. Yeah, so you're only conscious for 12 hours.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Come on. How do you guys determine, like... How do you just have a set rotation? Does it kind of vary?
Never mind. 6 days.
Schedule that's working.
Yeah.
Okay.
Did you just have a set rotation?
It varies a little bit because we stagger it so that if you're doing 2 hours on, 2 hours off at night, we don't switch everybody at the same time because then you would only be rowing the same person for 2 hours.
And
so it makes that feel mentally a lot shorter if an hour into your shift, the other person from the bow cabin or the stern cabin, whatever one you're not in, is switching with the other person on deck.
Yeah,
so it just, mentally makes the night go much quicker.
I mean, that's straight psychology, I would imagine, right? Like, you're breaking into it. Yeah, all that, like, it's, as you say, it's like, oh, of course.
Yeah.
It makes so much sense.
Yeah. I mean, there's times where you're just so fed up after the first hour, don't know how you're going to get through it, and then someone fresh pops out on deck, says something stupid, and you're just like, oh, that's hilarious. I'll keep rowing. I'm good.
Yeah. We've kind of also referenced a little bit to these practices that you all have embarked upon. Like, you mentioned 17 hours. You're just talking about a couple days. What does this look like? So you embark upon these multi-day rowing extravaganzas?
Yeah. No, it's a challenge. So we're required by the race to get 120 hours logged with just our team in our actual boat that we're going to race in, right?
Okay. Anyway.
So that's, yeah. So that's the starting point, you know, in terms of practice hours that you need to compete in the race. That's pretty low. You know, we've knocked that out of the park by now. The goal is to knock it out of the park, but that's the standard.
It's only six days.
Right. It's not that bad. 5 days.
5 days exactly. You are correct. Yeah.
The challenge for us was that we're from all over the world. So that was one of our initial thoughts was, okay, we need to be thinking about this big picture long term. How do we get everyone in the same spot? We ultimately settled upon Cleveland for several different reasons, but a major one being there's a huge body of water here that is, you know, doesn't have the same hydrological profile as the ocean, right? The waves are a little bit different, but they're arguably just as dangerous and just as probably harder to navigate. The waves in the Great Lakes are a lot smaller and closer together, but that kind of creates a more volatile environment when you're on a boat as opposed to wide, far apart ocean swell. Mm. So we knew that we were going to probably get all those hours on the lake, with 72 of those hours have to be on the ocean, which is why we trailered the boat to Florida this winter to knock those out. But yeah, it's just, you got to start small. Our first training row was like 15 hours. We felt like it was really challenging. We were wrecked after it. And it's just like, how are you going to do this? But we just scale it very slowly.
Sure.
So that was at the end of last fall. We knew we were going to do the Florida trip in February, and then we were going to knock out a bunch this summer. So we started this summer with a 20-hour row, scaled it up to 36, did a shorter row in really, really rough weather, challenging conditions. And then, you know, this past weekend we did almost a 60-hour row, and we're just going to kind of keep scaling it. And they don't get easier, but we get better at preparing for them. We get better in terms of kind of longevity of keeping our bodies and minds moving.
Yeah.
It's just slowly.
What's your goal to peak?
We're going to have, you know, probably like a 5-day, 4-night or 6-day, 5-night row.
Somewhere in there.
Which, you know, is really good. A lot of the teams that have had success in the past are like, you have to get at least one or two of those in. You'll be in a really good spot if you do. But even then, it's like you have a really good understanding of what it's going to take, but it's still almost unfathomable as to how long 30 days is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's insane. Now, it is really important that we mimic the first 5 or 7 days of the race, because that's when your bodies are acclimating. Virtually everybody's seasick. Everyone is at a super low point. You just kind of, it's just, you're staring down this daunting task. But arguably, you know, the weeks are going to get easier as they go on, just because you're into the rhythm.
Weeks. Like, that's crazy to say.
Yeah.
Seriously. We've been talking about it for an hour. I'm still blown away by it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just, you can't get off, you know? It's so mentally, you know, it's a lot.
Will you guys jump in the water? Will that be a thing?
Stop? Yeah.
Can you stop?
Yeah, you can.
Can you float?
Yeah.
Teams that are competitive and trying to win the race like we are, stop the least, sometimes not really at all. The real reason that we'll get into the water every few days is that you get this biofouling on the bottom of the hull. So it starts with microorganisms and then algae and then bigger barnacles and, you know, smaller kind of fish attaching to the boat. So every few days you want to jump in and use a scraper to scrape that stuff off because it creates friction and slows the boat down.
Okay.
So we'll do that every few days. And it's just, you got to be able to say if you do this that you swam over the Mid-Atlantic Ridge or in 20,000 feet of water.
Yeah, that's cool.
You know, it's pretty unique.
How do you guys feel about, and what do you do about the wild ocean, just the animals in the ocean, right? I mean, it's kind of going to be nuts to be in like a small boat compared to a whale that you're inevitably, I feel like, going to see throughout 30 days.
Yeah, you see a lot of incredible wildlife. You see pods of hundreds of dolphins. You see several different types of whales. The really interesting thing is that, you know, you see sharks and all that, but the biggest existential threat to teams and the only one that's ever really posed a risk are marlin, right? So they look like a swordfish, have a big pointy bill. And it's because it's become a bigger issue over the last 5 or 7 years, and nobody really knows why, but they tend to hunt the smaller fish that are feeding on the biofouling under the boat. And every year, at least a couple or three boats have a marlin pierce through the boat as they're hunting fish and miss or mistaken identity and punch a, you know, 2-3 inch hole in the bottom of the boat, and the boats start taking on water. But that's why race rules, we have to have all sorts of different underwater adhesives, marine adhesives, to patch holes real quick and keep on moving.
That's crazy. Yeah. I was just picturing someone sleeping and then just this marlin piercing through the...
Honest to God. There's like, yeah. It's like one of the things that you're just so scared of because it's 100% uncontrollable.
Yeah, right. There's nothing you can do.
Nothing you can do about it. Yeah, there will be a rule on board that if anyone rowing sees one around the boat, everybody gets out of the cabins, right? Just to kind of help yourself a little bit. But other than that...
So I feel like at night you're not going to be seeing it much.
No, right? Probably not at all. Black. Yeah.
I mean, you're just focusing on staying awake, so like, you know, looking, I mean, you're gonna be looking around and stuff, but even to, I don't know, just, that's another thing you gotta do, right? Look around for wildlife, right? Like, that's like one of the, probably the last things you're thinking of when you're just trying to keep your eyes open on the oars, or, you know, you're like just thinking about getting a snack in, just make like, oh, I gotta make sure I gotta eat. I gotta worry about these marlins or you know, other wildlife that could, you know,
threat. It's a huge challenge to be self-aware when you're not aware of yourself. Tag that one. That was sick. Yeah,
that was awesome.
Yeah. But yeah, like, we're going to be in major shipping lanes. There's going to be ships coming by, and we have all sorts of navigation equipment. We have alarms, proximity alarms, that if a ship comes within a certain distance of us, it'll go off so that we can, okay, this is an issue. We can look at our charts and see where we are and get out of the way of a huge container ship. But yeah, it's hard to do when you're barely awake in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
So I guess, you know, we practiced some drills on the water, like even going to the water and seeing what it would be like to, you know, harness yourself up, clean the hull. But I mean, I guess we haven't really talked about how important that would be in regards to the marlin, because, you know, I guess the cleaner the hull, you know,
faster you know, go.
Yeah, like faster you go, and you know, maybe less fish feeding on the stuff on the boat. Like, might be something you need to do more often. I don't know.
Do they get stuck in the boat?
I think their bills break off.
Yeah. Oh,
which doesn't sound good, fun either. Horrible. Doesn't sound good for them or us.
Yeah, I wasn't sure about that. I was just imagining myself like, oh, marlin. Like, would somebody have to just go? Wait, we got to bring like a saw the thing off, and then go saw a marlin off the boat, and then like
patch it up. Hey, Tony, we trained for this one. Get in there.
I don't know how that would go either. But
there's gonna be so much when you guys are out there that you're just gonna experience. I feel like, and get through it, and then you're just gonna be like, oh, we did not see that coming at all. Just
right.
Well, these things.
Yeah. You can prepare as much as you want, but it's such a volatile, you know, space that it's incredible. Another one of the big physical challenges out there is, you know, the height of the sea. You can get into waves that are 20 to 30 feet tall, sometimes a little bit bigger. But the key design feature of the boat is that it's self-righting. So if it capsizes, you know, turns over, it'll right itself. It's just hydrodynamically designed to do that.
That's incredible.
As long as you keep the hatches closed and there's no water ingress, right? So if someone was coming out of a hatch to get on deck to row and a huge wave swamped the cabin and we capsized, you know, it's not going to self-right. So there's like two golden rules. It's that we're always tethered to the boat. We have, you know, harnesses and tethers, and that we always keep the hatches closed, you know, as long as no one's getting in or out of the cabins.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you do those two things, you can get across alive. Those are the two big things that could kill you.
Has anyone died doing it?
There's been definitely several deaths over the years. With this race in particular, I don't know of that many. There was a gentleman that unfortunately passed from cardiac arrest two years ago in a team of four. And then I think there's been more instances of people doing it by themselves outside of the race that have died.
Yeah, sure.
Which again, it's like we pay a $20,000, $25,000 race entry fee, probably worth your life.
Life insurance policy.
Yeah.
Yeah, the cardiac arrest, there's not much you can do about it. I mean, it's terrible, but.
No. Yeah, and we go through all these medical sign-offs that we need to, you know, before we're allowed to start the race. But again, it's just, you don't know what your body's going to do under that kind of pressure for that long.
Yeah. What is it that each of you are most looking forward to about the race?
The finish.
Yeah. That's terrible to say when you're not even started yet.
It's funny, we asked, you know, when we were creating our website 3 years ago, that was one of the questions that we put into each of our profiles.
Yeah.
What are you most looking forward to? We were like a couple months into this. We had no idea what we were getting into. And I think I put something about like, I'm most excited for the problems that we're going to encounter and like our skills to like fix it. No, not at all. Not even close. Right. Are you kidding me? I think the highs are going to be incredible. You know, the lows are going to be awful. One thing that I've kind of learned in the training rows is like, as long as you're not seasick, life's pretty good out there. Like, even if you're in some physical pain, is like when you're seasick, which we've all been, it's you can't even get like gung-ho, like, oh, I'm going to push through this. Like, it's just so debilitating. So as long as we get past that, which we will eventually, you know, just the little things, having a meal when you're off the oars and joking with somebody, or we have all these little funny moments that are just compounding and just, you know, becoming really enjoyable.
I feel like that's ultimate like thrill seeking in a way, right? Like there's really high highs and there's really low lows. Like I think about, I don't know, I've never gone skydiving, but I feel like that moment when you're about to jump out of the plane, it's gotta be a really low low. You're like, I might die. And then you jump and then it's like, oh, that's sick.
Yeah.
You know? I don't know.
Yeah, 100%.
Anything thrill seeking is kind of like that. There's always that like really steep decline before you're at the top.
Yeah.
I think I had said something like, mine was very different from that. Like I said, I'm really excited to like hopefully see a whale and like in real close up and just hear like stories from, you know, these guys that I haven't heard before and just kind of like get to know each other better, because I think that experience, like it's already happening so much. I think especially with the Dr. Man, you know, psychological work as a team, it's like that for me helps learn more about like you guys, and then that just leads to like a more enhanced experience with your friends like out on the water.
Yeah.
And then especially like, you know, you talk about the highs and the lows, and I would say from our like college rowing days, that's what kind of like brought us together, is, you know, we loved getting like having a low, like making something, going and doing something really hard together, either outside of practice or like on the team with the entire team, and then getting to be in the aftermath of it and be like, oh, just that sucked, man. But like you're saying it in such a, like, it's like you're happy that it like sucked, you know, like it's like what came after it. That sense of achievement is something that, at least for me, like I really enjoy, and I think we're just having, like, the more we train, the more we do stuff, you know, the more moments like that we have, like, you know, Put-in Bay row. We rode out to Put-in Bay, and that was the shorter training trip that Dave was talking about, which was just like pretty much an overnight row, probably just around 15 hours. And it was just like the biggest waves we've probably seen. Everybody was seasick the entire time. Mm. Like, oh, just throwing up all night. But then we got there the next day, and it was like, you just get to laugh. Like, in the moment, it's so bad. But it's like getting to go to other people, at least for me, I love that, like getting to go and like share those stories with other people and, you know, seeing, you know, bringing like either joy or whatever to them through like those experiences is a pretty awesome feeling. So
absolutely,
it's just like that's like the highs and the lows, right? It's you get to tell those stories after.
Yeah.
Especially the lows, that's where the best stories come from.
It's always overcome
within reason.
I think it's pretty similar to what Dave and Tony are saying for me. With pretty much all of these rows, like there are just times when it sucks and I'm thinking about like why are we doing this? But then a couple hours later, it might have totally shifted and you're like just rowing into the sunset with some music and it's really cool. And it's a really, like, it's an amazing experience to get to do something like that, just like by human powered crossing the Atlantic, or even for our training rows, covering pretty large distances. Just a cool feeling. I think the highs kind of make up for for some of those tougher times.
The goal I had, the why I had at the outset, I think, was something like, I want to look at the stars. which is gonna, it's still gonna be cool, and I stand by that. That's gonna be awesome. And yeah, I guess building off that, it's really about just the simplicity of it. I'm looking forward to getting past the initial lows of the, first couple of days are gonna be terrible because your body just isn't used to that routine, that, seasickness, being out on the ocean, being covered in salt, being out in the sun all day. But I think we mentioned this earlier, I was having a terrible time this past weekend. We did a 60-hour training row. 12 hours, I was just brutally seasick. Like I've never been that seasick before, so I still don't totally know why. But 12 hours in, I'm just like, this is terrible. We have like 48 hours to go. On the ocean, we'll have like 40 days to go, 30 days to go, if that, this was the ocean. But on like day two, or I don't know, with like 24 hours in, 36 hours in, it just totally shifted. Like I had gotten out of the valley, I was kind of reaching the peak, and just the simplicity of rowing out in nature on the lake. I don't know. It was really satisfying, and there was a point on the row where I was like, I haven't felt this good for the past like 10 days. it was just like this ultimate high of like, wow, this is, I'm just watching the lake move. I'm watching the sky. I'm not behind a keyboard staring at a screen. I'm looking forward to that on the ocean of like just the simplicity of being in nature and being in an environment that most people like never get the opportunity to be in.
Yeah.
Speaking of other people, how do you navigate the opinions of everyone else and the thoughts? Man. I would imagine that, I know Mo, you mentioned the significant other, the lady in your life, and I just feel like the families, everyone probably has opinions, and out of, even a good, coming from a good place, out of love, maybe of great concern.
Yeah.
And, Is the risk worth the reward type of conversation? How do you navigate all those opinions?
Yeah. So funny story.
I have a story too.
Wait, I want to tell a story.
So, in high school, I started to get into this ultra endurance stuff. I did like if you ever heard of David Goggins, he had this challenge called the 4x4x48, which is you run 4 miles every 4 hours for 48 hours. So I did that in high school, and I was going to row in college, which isn't really ultra endurance, but I knew I wanted to do ultra stuff after. And my mom like knew about the Atlantic.
She literally thought it. It was the only thing on her list.
And he never does that. That's the one thing I never wanted.
The only thing on her list.
The only thing she didn't want me to do, and she never brought it up because she was probably scared I would do it if I found out or be interested in it.
Worked out well.
Yeah, exactly. Karma, right? So, it's a balance of, it's definitely stressful for loved ones. For all of our families, I think, are seeing someone you love go through, something this extreme and with, what many people would see as like, this is like this crazy thing, and why would you put yourself through that? Why would you put yourself at that risk? But I think ultimately it's like it's becoming the type of people that we need to be. And if we don't do it, that there's a balance of caring for others and also caring for yourself. And sometimes doing something like this is actually the best way to, you know, improve the lives of others around you.
Love it. I love it. Yeah.
To that point, like, all of our success has been from the realization that, like, you need to live out the mission that we established to execute this. You know, our broad mission that's on file with the IRS is to provide opportunities for youth to pursue a better version of themselves, but we've condensed that into just pursuing better. And what we kind of tell everyone that gets people that don't have a great opinion about what we're doing kind of, you know, turn the right direction is, like, that doesn't mean yet we're not trying to get people to go row an ocean. Mm-hmm. You know, we're trying to get people to make the next best decision in their lives to become a better version of themselves and realize you have dozens and dozens of opportunities to do that every day. It could be, you know, it could be a physical challenge for sure, but it could be having a hard conversation with a loved one that needs to happen, or doing something at work, or stop smoking, or whatever it is. Yeah. It's incredible the feedback that we've gotten. We've gotten, you know, we love people that they hear what we're doing and it just resonates and they freak out. You know, this guy, Steven, that was our coxswain in college, that was that Cornell connection. Like, I remember, I'll never forget the phone call that I had with him when I told him what we're doing. I mean, he shot up to the moon. He's like, what can I do right now with the very little free time that I have to push this forward?
So cool.
And he's been a huge part of our success. And then we meet people that are totally disinterested. You tell them you're rowing across the ocean, it just doesn't resonate with them, or they just can't even grasp it, they just don't care. And there's been a few people that are just like, that's stupid. Why would you do that? You know?
They probably have really fun and exciting lives.
Yeah, right? And it's like, you know, it's such a mix. But I think, I mean, even people that really believed in us and knew us well kind of like wrote it off. Not in a bad way, but they're just like, yeah, I don't think that's probably going to come to fruition, you know? And we've had people admit that to us. Like 3 years later, like, we just keep seeing you building and building and doing it and doing it. Like, this is incredible.
I can't help but think, like, too, if at this point, or even probably back when the ideas were getting floated around, if you just didn't do it, that's one of those decisions that in the back of your mind, I don't know, like, I personally, something like this, couldn't live with that decision. Like, oh, well, what if I would have done it? That's horrible. That's worse than whatever you guys are about to go through.
For,
you know?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. What does our sports psychologist say? The difference between regret. I forget what the comparison was, but when we were flushing out, you know, our ideas and goals of our whys and what does success look like in this, you know, he said regret is like fear of inaction. You know, I forget what he was opposing it against, but that was a big motivating factor of why we're doing it. You know, we have all these past experiences. We want to kind of use our past experiences to do something good for the world. And I think that we all just would have kind of, especially once we learned about it, I think we would have regretted it for a long time if we didn't fully commit to it.
Yeah, 100%. The loved ones are going to be there. I don't want to be good.
Oh, man. They're
Can you guys talk to them at all? Like, dude, how's that going to get?
Yeah, no, it's incredible in 2025 what you can do. So we'll have three different sat phones, you know, one for safety, one for emergencies, and one that we can call our loved ones at any time. You know, you don't want to do it too much because you want to be out there. You don't want them to worry or anything, but we'll have some really good conversations with them. We'll have Starlink, so we can send back pictures and videos in real time, anywhere out there. You know, we can do a follow-up chats with Clark from
the
sea.
We will. Yeah. We're going to bring it back here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Love to.
That's amazing.
It's amazing how connected you can be.
Okay, so it's worth bringing the phone and playing Freebird 4,800 times. So
there you go. That's all it takes. What?
That's it. 4,800 times. Where do we check out the boat, fellas? Huh?
Let's go.
Let's do
check out the boat.
Let's do it.
We're on set now at the boat that will be riding across the Atlantic Ocean. We do a closing litany here at Chats with Clark, and there's usually four questions to some degree that I ask the guest, the person with whom I'm chatting. But given that we have four gentlemen here, we're going to break it up question by question. Fellas, the first question I have for you is, what role does gratitude play in your life? For me, very simply, I think that people who live gratefully have happier lives, point blank.
I think gratitude is a huge part of our journey to get to rowing across the Atlantic. I think we are just deeply grateful, first of all, for the resources and opportunities that we've had to lead us to this point. So, for example, through Hobart Rowing or through the HWS experience in general, that allowed us to challenge ourselves, become better versions of ourselves, and That's a big part of our mission, to give back to youth who might not have these same chances. So I think we all have a ton of, we're really grateful for these opportunities. We're so grateful that we get the chance to actually do this row. We've had so much help from family, from sponsors, from donors, that, yeah, it's just a huge blessing that we're able to do it, even though, you know, sometimes it's tough, but it's a huge opportunity and chance for us that we are grateful for.
Absolutely. I imagine on day pick your poison later into it, you're going to be tapping into those things that you're grateful for, because you need it. It's motivating. And kind of similarly to that, I feel like the regrets in our life are something that maybe guide us, because we take a lesson from them. So do you have any regrets in your life? And if so, what have you learned from those regrets?
I think the thing that's hard for me about regrets is the idea of having a regret is, you know, wishing that I would be someone else right now, someplace else. So I wouldn't say I have any major regrets, as in, like, I'm very grateful for where I am now. There have been little regrets of, like, you know, I should have had this conversation with this person sooner. I should have, trained harder, or not trained as hard as I should have, and, you know, maybe I injured myself. I think what regrets have, those, you know, small little regrets have taught me is just, I haven't really regretted anything majorly in my life, and
maybe this is it.
Maybe I'm about to learn the lesson.
It's absolutely that gratitude piece for me, right? Like,
yeah.
The second you have a perspective of, like, all right, it's all part of the journey, and that I can take something from it, then even those tough moments end up being something so transitional, so something that you better your life from, right? You make towards a better version of yourself. You have to have a low moment. It can't be the high ones all the time. So
exactly. I like that. Yeah, it's those little regrets are not actually regrets, because they've resulted in the person that I am today. Mm-hmm. So, you know, all the mistakes I've made, I feel that I've learned from them. You know, I haven't been, there have been, you know, you got to recognize the times in your life that are out of your control, and you got to know when they are in control. And I think it's not so much as framing them as regrets, but just moments of learning.
Yeah. It kind of ties into that mission, right? And when we talk about bettering ourselves, there's a chance that we can influence the youth, we can influence others. How do you hope that this mission, that your journey, influences other people to go and be the best versions of themselves?
Yeah, in terms of the influence I think that we want to have as a team by doing this just crazy thing is, you know, we were fortunate to have people in our lives that pushed us past our limits in moments, you know, way back, and we're here now because of it. So, you know, making people, or helping people realize the people in their lives that are doing that for them, and then going and, you know, trying to maybe be that person for somebody else. So in terms of youth, you know, we're trying to raise some awareness around, there's kids out there that, you know, they don't have the opportunities that either we had or other people have to go in and do something, because they're worried about maybe, you know, putting food on the table, or bad situations at home and stuff. They got bigger worries than, what race am I going to do this year? What, something like that. So providing an opportunity for those kids to go and push themselves and do something that they otherwise wouldn't have been able to. And what does that take? It takes that person in your life to go and tell them, like, hey, you can do this thing. You can be the best version of yourself. You don't see that best version of yourself, but I do. So, just spreading that environment to people that might not have access to it.
Yeah, that's beautifully put, right? I think that's kind of what love is. I always have thought that love is finding the best person, the best, well, an individual could be, and seeing that and almost believing it through, right? And it's like you mentioned, even in times sometimes where it's like that person may not even see it themselves. Mm-hmm. The last question I have kind of tailors all of this and puts it into one. If you had any advice you want to offer to a specific group of people in general or the audience as a whole, what would that piece of advice be?
So there's a famous quote in ocean rowing that you can't cross an ocean if you're afraid to lose sight of shore. So if I were to kind of put that into perspective of what it means for us, and what kind of advice we could lend to our audience or to anyone is to do what we're doing in creating a safety net and a network. You know, for us, it's our advisory boards, our families, our all of our stakeholders, so that we can go out and try to do something that is completely overwhelming, right? That we 3 years ago could not do, 2 years ago could not do. You know, right now we're just on the verge of kind of, being able to accomplish this. And come 5 months from now, we're going to be in a good position to do it. But we have that support system to take that leap of faith and hold us up in our worst moments. So the advice would be to, even if you don't have all the answers, just start making decisions and taking action.
It's amazing. It's so good. Yeah, ships are safe in the harbor, right? But that's not what ships are built for.
Damn straight.
So good. This is Team Seneca Navy. They're going to be rowing across the Atlantic Ocean. Usually we kind of go, most people maybe visit the beach, hang out for a couple days and then leave. They're gonna do it for 30 days. I'm giving you guys 30 days, if not a world record before then. 30 days. Again, Team Seneca Navy, we have Ryan, David, Tony, and Mo. Thank you all so much for being here. You guys are amazing. This was an absolute pleasure. This is episode 55 of the Chats with Clark podcast. Follow what Team Seneca is doing. I will have everything linked in the description below. Make sure you're checking it out, following along. Hit that donation button on the main page, and definitely hit that subscribe button if you haven't already. We don't know what you're waiting for over here at Chats with Clark. We try and just give you top tier content, but you don't hit the subscribe button. I don't know what to tell you. So this has been episode 55. Gentlemen, thank you so much.
Thanks, Joe.
Absolutely.
It's a pleasure.